All right, so at this time, I should briefly qualify the requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group. Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, which I have Central as your home group, that's me, and attend a group conscience meeting, which I did. Those are pretty much the only requirements. You don't have to remember names. You don't really have to get here 15 minutes early like you're supposed to, even though I try. Basically, I'm not a perfect person. I came here because I was broken. I couldn't live life without drinking, and I couldn't live life drinking. That's the bottom line. I ran out of solutions. And you guys had a way out. You had been in the same place. Maybe not exactly the same place on the surface, but your feelings were the same. You had no more solutions, and you'd found one too, and you showed me how, through a sponsor, I was able to work the steps of the program, which are outlined in the big book, that big blue book, the first
164
pages. I swear I read it. I swear I did. Long-term memory problems. Anyway, I don't want to take too much time because this person... oh, wait a minute. I have to remind you to... basically, AA saved my life. Keep coming back. If you think it won't, it will. You're in the right place if you're in an AA meeting on a Saturday night. The group has... Thank you. And also, this is my last week chairing, so thank you for letting me do service. It's been fantastic. It's been a real honor. The group has asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and to refrain from moving or talking while the speaker is sharing. And I just want to say that this woman changed my life, really. She changed my life. She saved my life. Through her service, I was able to understand the 12 steps in a way that helped me to use them on a daily basis. I never knew how they were supposed to work in my life. They seemed so far away. And she brought them to me. She explained what the book meant. She explained how they work in her life, and that worked for me. And it's a huge honor for me to give you Heidi.
Did you want to handle that for a little bit?
How's that work?
I think it's good.
No, no. Get in there, get in
there. All right. All right. I got it. I think everyone can hear me. Yeah. I'm Heidi, I'm alcoholic. Thank you, Matt. You're just the most darling ever. If you haven't gotten to know Matt, you should get to know Matt. Not liking Matt is a little bit like kicking puppies. It's kind of weird and slightly degenerate. So he's a great guy. I want to thank the group for allowing me the opportunity to serve in the way that I will tonight. I'm here to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My sobriety date is March 18th, 1987. My home group is Central. And I just want to make mention of a new home away from home group that I've been going to. It's not a new group. It's new to me. It's the College Park Triangle. excellent solution-oriented group on Thursday night at 7. Bryn Mawr. It's a great group. Central is my home group, and I have to say that I feel very at home here. I do. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt as though I did not fit anywhere. I'm going to kind of start at the beginning. I was born in 1959. Yes, I know. Yeah. Vanessa calls me well-preserved. in a very small town in northern Italy called Strettoia. We came to the United States when I was 9 years old. I became a naturalized citizen at 12. Before we came to the United States, my life was rather tumultuous. The adults in my family were making decisions that were affecting all of us. And one of my earliest memories is gathering with the family for dinner. We were just outside of Rome, and there was a large group of us. My favorite uncle, Panfilo, was with us. He always made me feel safe. And as we were leaving the restaurant and he was holding my hand, a man came up behind him and shot him in the head. And as a really little girl, this unsettling event left me in a place where I was kind of always expecting something to go terribly wrong. It wasn't long after that that in the parochial school that I was going to, just about 17 miles from the Vatican, an event occurred that affected the way that I felt about myself and about the outside world. I'd gotten called to the Mother Superior's office, which, if you're a little kid in Catholic school, the Mother Superior has like the bat phone to God. And so it was me and two little boys, David Alferi and Joey Capabianca. I will never forget this. We're taken into the Mother Superior's office, and all of our families were there. My mother was crying, and my father's vein in the center of his forehead was poking out. And I was very afraid. And what happened next was they informed the families that these three children were children of the devil. We'd been acting out on deviant behavior. We all wrote with our left hands. And so we were then strip searched, and our heads were shaved, and we were searched for the mark of the child of the devil, which I'm pretty sure would have been far more interesting than just a child of the devil, but there are no sixes on me. So at age six, I wasn't even part of the human race. And here's a beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. All those years I spent with this horrible resentment toward the church and this idea that I just didn't fit changed with the steps. Because the people in that room that day, although there was a damaging effect to some degree, people in that room were wanting to save my soul. They weren't trying to hurt these three little children. The idea was, these children are in danger. We need to help them. I have had an exorcism performed on me, which is hard to believe for those who know me. My boyfriend figures it didn't work. So, fast forward a little bit. My father was in love with the idea of becoming a United States citizen. He knew a lot about the Constitution, about American history, and just thought that the land of the free and the home of the brave was the place to go, because shit was going down. Bitches be tripping in Italy. Right? So he decided to move his young family to the United States, and I can remember many hours sitting with my family reading the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and preparing to come to the United States. And it was very important to my mother that when we got here that we were very American. And so learning to speak the language and articulate in American English was very important where I come from. I did pretty good, right? Yeah, right? So you ought to hear me when I'm mad. So we came to the U.S. I was about 9 years old when we got here, and unfortunately, I really, for the first time, had an opportunity to see my father's heart broken. The American president was being impeached because he had lied to his peoples. And that really had a profound effect on all of us. My father was definitely the king of his castle, and we really did follow his lead in every way. So I was excited to be in a place where they didn't know I was a child of the devil yet. Maybe I could keep the secret for a minute. And it felt like a fresh start. So I felt very comfortable at first here, and it became apparent that I was different. within just a few months, I remember being outside the church and I was playing with a little girl, and my poor father, he built a house in the middle of a neighborhood that was so white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, he just didn't know where he was. And we were brown and we talked funny and we were from somewhere else, and that just wasn't all that cool at that time. And so I was outside playing with this little girl, and her mother came out and snatched her away from our little game and said, "I told you not to play with that little guinea." I didn't even know what that meant. So I asked my mother, "What's a guinea?" And she said, "It's a beautiful little Italian girl." Right? So, no matter what, I did find out what that meant, and it occurred to me that, again, I didn't fit. And I started to develop some survival mechanisms and some coping skills. And my coping skills were kind of something like this: fight for it, force it, fake it, or fuck it, let's have a drink. And that worked for a long time. That was my solution. And fast forward, I did very well in school. I became addicted to the limelight. And so I wanted to excel in everything that I did. And I was an excellent student and an excellent athlete and an excellent fighter, faker, forcer, and fuck it kind of a girl. And my father had decided that it was important for me to go to an Ivy League school and get an excellent education so that I could do the American dream thing. And he thought that I should enter law school, and I wanted to be an artist. And so it came down to the last few moments before the final decision was going to be made. I'd been accepted at several schools, and he wanted me to go to Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, and I didn't want to go there. And so I knew I was going to have to sit down and talk to him about it. So I wrote out this sort of plan for how my future was going to evolve as an artist, and I made bullet points, and I had several excellent arguments for why I should be going to art school. And so we sat down and we had this talk, and he said, "So you think that the best thing that you could be in your life is an artist? You think that's what you're really great at?" And I said, "Yes, Daddy, that's exactly what I think." And he said, "You just made an excellent argument. I think what you're good at is arguing." Sounds like law to me. So I did go and get a degree in Western Humanities, which makes me really good at Jeopardy. And then I went to art school. And I've been a professional artist my entire adult life. In my early 20s, I found the punk movement, which felt very, very comfortable to me. Actually, I met a boy who had a shaved head, and I thought he was so cool. So I sort of wanted to belong to something, and this was a militant, angry group of young people who were also artists, and I fit right in. And I learned a couple of very valuable things hanging out with this crowd. I learned how to make a mohawk stick straight up with Elmer's glue. Awesome. And I learned an excellent equation for selling drugs. So this is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a big portion of my story has to do with drug abuse. I will do my very best to respect our singleness of purpose. However, it's my story, and I am going to talk a little bit about it. So I will apologize in advance if it offends you in any way. So I was doing art, and I was getting paid a lot of money, and I was a street pharmacist at night. And I was making a lot of money. And I've always seemed to be drawn to these industries that are kind of male-dominant. I don't know how that... I'm a tattoo artist now, and it's also a male-dominant industry. Anyway, I started getting into trouble. Of course I did. The thing about being the drug dealer is you fit. Everybody wants to know you. Everybody wants to hang out with you, right?
Right.
So I believe to this day that I was engaging in that behavior for emotional reasons more than anything else. I just really wanted to feel like I belonged to something. So I began to get arrested frequently. And I grew up privileged, so oftentimes my family bailed me out of trouble. And I made a lot of jackpot phone calls to my family, a lot of them. So fast forward a little bit, I had decided that I was going to come here to Florida from Pennsylvania and collect a large quantity of pharmaceuticals fit for sale in the great Northeast. And I thought I had a little bit, and what had happened while I was here, someone lined my car, and when I got pulled over, just coming into Pennsylvania, my car was searched, and I thought I had this much, and really I had that much, and I was in a lot of trouble. And it looked like I was going to go to jail for a very, very long time. And as it turns out, we found out that it was my brother who had lined my car. And when I spoke with my father about it, he said to me, if your brother goes to jail, it will kill him. You're going to have to do this. So, of course, in my subconscious, it was like, well, if I have one kid that is a child of the devil and I have one normal kid, why would I not want to put the devil in the can? Logic. So it was a long appeals process, but after a lot of time, energy, effort, and money, I did get out of jail. I think God had a different plan for me. And so I decided to go back to my job on a smaller scale, a little more manageable to have a small business than a conglomerate. So I was going along my merry way, and it was St. Patrick's Day, and I decided I was going to go drink some green beer at Mitchell's Irish Pub downtown, across from number one police station, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And, so I was really drunk, and there was this big Irish guy talking about how great the Irish people are, which kind of pissed me off. Because what nobody ever talks about is St. De Pasquale had a Roman mother. Yes, he was Italian, not Irish. Kiss my ass. So I got mouthy with him. I don't remember exactly what I said, and made some comment about his fat potato-eating mother. And he was getting angry, and I was getting belligerent, and next thing I know, he's pushed me. He shoved me. And I just never had that flight thing. I had the fight thing down. Like, I was good at that. But the flight thing, not so much. It didn't matter how big he was. I had two brothers growing up. I knew what to do. So I punched him in his throat. And as he was gasping for air, I was simply explaining to him that he didn't calm down and relax. I had not broken anything. He would get his air back in just a few minutes, but if he didn't calm down, he was going to pass out. All of his muscles were going to relax, and he was going to pee his pants. So calm the fuck down. And then I went back to the bar to drink my beer, right? I figure it's a no-lose situation. If he beats me up, he beat up a girl. If I beat him up, he got beat up by a girl. I can't really lose. Except for this little detail. So he comes over to the bar angry and embarrassed. Of course he was. And he emptied out my purse. And I had a little contraband in there. And then he took out his badge. Yeah, I'm across the street from the police station. Duh! So there I was in jail again. And I called my mother again, and for the very first time, she said, we're done. stay, rot. If you ever get a year sober, give us a call. I want three people to corroborate that you are sober a year. Other than that, don't call anybody in this family. We're done with you. I'm tired of watching you kill yourself a day at a time. So, I was like, what kind of mother are you? So I stayed for a little while, and then I talked to a judge, and she said something miraculous. She said, I don't think you're a bad person. I think you're sick. And this was the treatment era in sobriety. And I said, sick? I'm sick? You think I'm sick? How about this freaking guy? He's sick. If he would leave me alone, everything would be all right. I'm not sick, judge. She said, well, you have a couple of choices. You can either be sick and go to Gateway Rehabilitation Center, or he can be sick, and you can go back to Muncie State Correctional Facility for Women. And I said, I don't feel well. So I went, and believe it or not, I heard some things there. I heard some things. And I'd been to a meeting before, years prior to that, and I am going to mention it, and please hear me all the way out. I'd been to a meeting prior to that, and after the meeting, an old-timer approached me and said, you are never going to be able to get sober if you do not accept the Lord Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. And I looked at him, and I said, well, I'm straight fucked because Jesus doesn't like me, okay? So I mention that because we want to be very cautious about the way we treat newcomers. I know that I want to be very cautious about the way we treat newcomers. And our program suggests that the highway is broad and roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive. So anyway, I'm at this treatment center, and I was at an individual therapy session with a really good therapist, by the way. And he was telling me the truth, and I didn't like that, not one bit. And he kept telling me the truth, and I asked him to be quiet. He told me some more truth, and I told him to shut the fuck up. He told me some more truth, and I grabbed him around the throat. So I made it like 27 days, though, right? I mean, that's something. It was a 28-day program. I made it 27 days. I got expelled for an act of violence. The marks went away like in 3 days. I don't know what everybody was so upset about. So I was very fortunate that I wasn't violated. I did go back in front of the judge, and by then I was ready to go back. I had been sober for a little while, and I knew I was in trouble, and I had a posse with me in the courtroom, and I ended up remaining free. So now I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm at my first meeting, and I'm in the back of the room, and I've got my strongest hate face on because I don't want anybody to talk to me. I don't want to hug you. I don't want your number. I'm not a joiner. I do not have an honest desire to stop drinking. Are you kidding? That's retarded. I do have an honest desire to quit going to jail. So I'm going to play the game because I know the judge likes this AA crap. And so I'm in the back of the room, and they're about to do the chips. And the reason I was there for that first meeting is because I was desperate. I was desperate. But I'm about to tell you why I came back to my second meeting. Because when it came to, would anyone like to join our way of life? The girl who was doing the chips was a Midwestern lady named Debbie. She looked like somebody split an apple in half and pasted them on her cheeks. And this is the late 80s, so she had this huge hair, right? It arrived 10 or 15 minutes before her. And she was a big lady, and I went up to get my white chip, and she just took me up in that hug, you know, that hug, that big Midwestern mom hug. And just between me and her, she just whispered in my ear. She said, welcome home. And it was private. It was just between she and I. And for the first time, I fit somewhere. 27 years ago this month, and it still affects me this way. So that was why I came back the second day. I want to encourage you to be very careful with the newcomer. She saved my life that night because I wanted to come back to the next meeting. And I did. So they said get a sponsor. The group that I kind of latched on to early in my sobriety really stressed the importance of sponsorship and the book and this system for living that wasn't a theory. So I got a sponsor. She was a full-blooded Italian, and she hated everyone. I loved her. She was perfect for me. And she took me through the book, word for word, line for line. The first thing she did is she picked up the book. She went to that very first page that's blank. And she said, this is what you know about living, so shut the fuck up. It's blank. This is everything you know about being a human being. So learn to listen, to listen, to learn. You will not speak for the next 30 days in a meeting. You will listen. Fine. I don't like you people anyway. I just don't want to go to jail. So she took me through the steps, and she took me through the book, and, you know, I started to change. In spite of myself, I started to change. And I'd gone through the steps, and I was now reaching out to new girls, and I'd started to sponsor this girl, and she was going through a difficult time in her sobriety, and I began to share with her part of my story. I thought it would help. That's what we do, right? We take those dark secrets from our past, and we use them to avert misery and death. Good AA that I am. And so as I told her the story, she finished it. And I'd only ever told that story one time. And that was during my fifth step conversation with my sponsor. And so I was panicky. And I thought that perhaps my sponsor had shared it with her to try to help her. And so I asked her how she knew the story. And she said, well, your sponsor was at my mother's house last weekend, and we were all playing cards, and we were having a few laughs talking about your fifth step conversation. So two things. I'm living proof that you can survive that. I didn't have to drink over it. So if that's your fear, do the fourth step, do the fifth step. You won't die. We're only a legend in our own mind. Now, it took a while to get to that. People here know my story. I wanted to kill her dog. I made plans to kill the dog. Yes, I've made plans to kill the dog. And I needed a driver. So there was this other girl in sobriety named Tracy Smith, and Tracy was the kind of girl in the 80s that everything matched. And if she was wearing pink, I mean pink eye makeup, pink tennis shoes, pink pants, pink fingernail polish, pink lipstick, she was an annoying little bitch. But she had a dependable car. So I told her what I was going to do. I told her what happened. I figured justifiably angered by this incident. I mean, it's kind of a cardinal rule, right? We don't do that to each other. How could I not? What was my part in that bullshit, right? So Trace is like, you're right, we should kill the dog. I'm going to come pick you up. I'll be there in a little bit. And I had tools. I was prepared. So she comes and picks me up, and she's like, okay, we're going to go kill the dog in a little bit, but I got to go over here for a minute, and then we'll go. So this crazy pink-clad little girl drove me all to every big box store in freaking Pittsburgh that morning, and it was later in the day, and it was time for a meeting. And she said, are you sure you want to kill that dog? Is that really going to make you feel better? And she talked to me about some of her experiences in getting past, and the only way past is through. And she suggested that I get a new sponsor and perhaps try again. And because of her love and consideration and understanding and patience, I did not kill a dog that day. I did, however, recognize the importance of getting a sponsor that I could feel more comfortable with. And Tracy taught me how to detach without malice, and that I could have a comfortable space between me and my original sponsor, because I was going to have to see her at meetings. So here's the thing. When I told that story just now, we all did it, didn't we? We all judged her. Every one of us judged her. But all she really wanted was for those people at that card game to think she was funny. She wanted to fit, didn't she? She wanted them to like her. And how many of us have felt that way? So, from God through you, I learned by working the steps and having a spiritual awakening that even something as painful as that kind of betrayal of trust could change me for the better. It taught me how to forgive. It taught me how to be trustworthy. I would never want anyone to feel the way I felt that day. Plus, I didn't want anybody to kill my dog. Right? So, now I'm at a meeting, and I'm beginning to balk because I got my feelings hurt. And I'm again in the meeting saying, don't touch me, don't talk to me, I'm not a joiner, I don't want your number, you're all full of shit, half of you are drunk, this is bullshit, if I didn't have a freaking case coming up, I'd be gone, blabbity, blabbity, blabbity. And this big, beautiful black woman, I mean, she seemed enormous to me, came up to me after the meeting and she said, girl, you hard-headed, what's your name? Who the fuck are you? She said, oh, I'm your new sponsor, that's who. Okay. This is my phone number, you call me tonight. I mean it, tonight. And I did. To this day, I don't know why. This woman became a woman that I could not only trust, but confide and rely upon. And she taught me how to apply the steps in my life. And she taught me how to love unconditionally. And she taught me how to walk through difficulty with a little grace and some dignity. She didn't teach me by giving me some kind of equation or syllabus. She showed me by the way that she lived her life. And I was very streety. I needed someone who was regimented. And she taught me discipline, self-discipline, as well as the willingness to allow God to discipline me in a way that I had never been disciplined before. So, after Dot died, I just moved to Florida. My mother had just passed away. And we'd made our amends and become really best friends. And I'm very grateful for that time that I had with her as a sober alcoholic. One of my final memories of her was in her last week on the planet, and she'd asked me to come and sit on her lap. And the same woman that left me in jail that day said, I'm so proud of you. You're my angel. So I'm not a demon anymore, now I'm an angel. I believe in my heart that that could not have been possible without Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I moved down here. I'm married and very much in love with a practicing alcoholic. My picker is so broken. Dear God. And at some point, I'm cleaning out a closet and all kinds of paraphernalia comes down and hits me in the head. And we'd been struggling and he'd been struggling. And it became clear to me that my sobriety was in jeopardy. And I never quit loving that guy, not for one second. But I knew I had to go. I knew I had to go. So I had recently joined Central as my home group after not having gone to a meeting for 6 months. Do not recommend that at any level in your sobriety. Not for one second. It gives me the heebie-jeebies just thinking about it. However, I was new here at Central, and I felt very grounded, and I had a lot of support through that difficult time, and he ended up getting sober. I believe he got sober to get his wife and his life back. That was not going to happen because you piss off a Dago and it's done. You're done. However, it doesn't matter how he got here. What matters is that he stayed, and he's remarried and has a little boy, which is awesome. And I'm much happier. I'll never stop loving him, but I would rather have sex with a rabid dog than ever date him again. Just saying. So after Dot died, as my sponsor, I took on another one of her sponsees. It was the same sponsorship line. It was the same voice almost, and it felt very comfortable to me. And she began to travel quite a bit, and it was more and more difficult for me to get in touch with her. And what happened eventually was I was resting on my laurels, and I didn't know it. You could not have, if you'd have asked me, are you a good, strong AA, I'd have said yes, and I'd have meant it 100%. And I will let you know right now that we do not build up a tolerance. We do not graduate. We do not get to that place where we're immune to drinking. I hear people say this all the time. Drinking's not an option. Well, it may be an argument of semantics, but I will tell you that if you are an alcoholic, it has been my experience, drinking is an option. The stress level gets high enough, and you're not in fit spiritual condition, I don't care how long you've been sober, how many people you're sponsoring, how many home groups you have, kiss my ass, you will think about drinking. Sorry. That's just been my experience, my personal experience, and my experience watching other people. So here's the thing. I've got like this very weak sponsorship thing going on. I'm going to maybe 2 meetings a week. I've got 1 sponsee. I'm still praying, but I'm not really in the literature anymore. I'm not really meditating for any period of time. I am slipping away, and I don't know it because my life has gotten so big. When I moved out from my ex, I very quickly picked my broken picker, picked a new one. And, you know, we had bought a house together, and we had a dog. We might as well have been married. Thank Christ and all the saints we weren't. But so I'm with this guy, and every single thing I put in front of my sobriety, I lost eventually. And I usually lost it in a way that was so incredibly painful. I sometimes think that if you saw an x-ray of me, there would be little dings all over my skeletal structure. So at 22 years of sobriety, I come home and I find my common-law husband in my big, beautiful Tempur-Pedic bed, which I miss. Yeah, he was in there with my friend. They weren't reading. Kind of a difficult visual to get rid of, trust me. So here I was with a cataclysmic event in my life, and I was not on a very strong spiritual ground. So I was in danger. And so I managed to get her social security number. Oh, yeah. I was going to get her. And here I am again, plotting death, destruction, murder, whatever. And I have a friend from Central who showed up on my door. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm plotting murder. What do you think I'm doing? You know what just happened." And he's a truth teller. See, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've surrounded myself with truth tellers. And so my truth teller came and he said, "Get your bubble gum, we're going to go talk." And he is a chain smoking, coffee drinking alcoholic. And I'm like, "I'm in my pajamas. It's late. I don't need to talk. Please, George, just we'll do it. Come on, we're going to go." So we sat, I was in my pajamas and my fur coat at Starbucks on Orange Avenue. It was awesome. And what he said to me was, "You're full of shit and you're going to die." And I said, "Don't mince words, buddy. I know you love me, but I'm not really sure what all that means." And he says, "You keep telling me you know everything to do, and you're doing it, and you're not feeling better, and you're feeling more and more upset all the time, but you know what to do, you know what to do, you know what to do." Translation of that means that there's nothing more for you to learn. And there's always more for you to learn. So you're full of shit and you're going to die. You need to change. You need to make a change. Get a sponsor and have them take you through the steps. You need a spiritual awakening or you're going to drink. And he was right. I did have thoughts of drinking during that time. I got very fortunate and did not drink, but I had those thoughts. And a couple of weeks into this whole experience, my friend Nina and her husband and my other friend Dion, a group of us were all going to go to dinner, and so I walked up to my friend Nina and I said, what I thought I was going to say was, what time are we supposed to meet on Friday? And what came out was, will you please take me through the steps? I need a sponsor. What? I had no intention of asking her to be my sponsor that day, but I believe that God had a different plan for me. And I know that now I fit here, so I'm going to stay. And she had me doing some rigorous work. So we're at a sponsorship meeting, and she brings out this very, like, thick guide of doing the fourth step from a workbook, idiot's guide to blah, blah. Have you done this before? And I'm like, no, I've never done that. And I'm, because that's me. I want to work it out, right? I want to fight for it. That's how I am. Push-ups. I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'm willing. I don't want to drink. She says, so have you done it? No, but it looks like work. Let's do it. Let's make it happen. And she's like, oh, no, you're not doing that. You think you can work this out? You think you have the power to work this out? This is not manageable by you. Your management has put you in this position right here, right now. No managing. This bitch is this big, and she's talking like that to me. And I'm going, okay. So I said, well, what would you have me do? And she said, well, I'd like you to look in your closet. What do you see there? And I said, order. What colors? Black, red, gray, black. When was the last time you talked to a child? I'm like, I don't like children. They are like little germ carriers or something. And they hang around other little germ carriers all day. So she said, your assignment is to dance with an old person, to hold a child, to wear a pink sweater. This shit is lighting my hair on fire, right? I want to do the push-up. Can we go back to the four-step guide thing? So once again, just like in my early sobriety, I had court cases, I had all kinds of shit going on, and they're saying, work the steps, and you're going to be fine, everything will work out, and I'm like, I have real problems, what I need is an attorney, and they're saying, no, work the steps, it'll all work out. It seemed absurd, but I did it, and they were right. So here again, she's got me going through the book, doing the steps, but she's got these little add-ons with the germ carrier and the old person and the pink sweater. And it seems absurd, which logic says it'll probably work. And I'm desperate again. I'm desperate. And I was listening to a speaker's tape or something, and the speaker said, if you want to get back on the pink cloud, do what you did in your first 90 days. What did you do in your first 90 days that you're not doing now as a sober alcoholic? And I'm like, just everything. So I started reading my literature every day. I asked God a very simple prayer, please help me stay sober today. And at night I said thank you on my knees both times. And I started reaching out to newcomers, and I focused on trying to be of service each and every day. What could I pack into the stream of life? Not what could I take away from life. And I got involved. I got back in the middle of the bed. I started going to meetings every day. And what I found is that I landed on that pink cloud again. And I haven't been off. So these days when I'm fretted or vexed, irritable or sore, I recognize that I'm probably in management. So if I can accept, not just admit, that I'm powerless over whatever it is and that it's not manageable by me, that will lead me to the next step, which is to say to myself, now it would be insane for me to try to manage this. I used to do that before and it never worked. So I know that something can restore me to sanity, and I'm positive I can rely on it because I've done it a million times. So I'm going to turn my will, my life, and this situation over to that thing that is keeping me sober. And then if I'm still upset about it, I'm going to write it down in a four-column format, and I'm going to talk to somebody that I trust, and I'm going to say, this is what's bothering me. Do you have any experience on it? And they're probably going to share with me what their experience is, and then they're going to help me to identify what the self-centered fear or quote-unquote character defect is that led me to this discomfort in the first place. And they're going to say, are you entirely ready to get that shit out of here and give that to God? Even though sometimes it still works for you. And by this time, I'm in enough pain and I say, yes, I'm ready. Well, in this process, you might harm somebody. Maybe we should take a look at that. And so I'm going to look at it. And if there's a list, I'm going to amend after some careful contemplation and talking to a sponsor about it, that situation. Then for 3 or 4 days, I'm going to spot check the inventory, make sure that I'm not acting out on the behavior that led me to the jackpot in the first place. Then I'm going to sit quietly with what I've learned. And the very next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take that, because now I've had a spiritual awakening. I'm going to take that experience and I'm going to put it in my little Rolodex. And the next time I'm talking to somebody and they are fretted or vexed, irritable or sore, I'm going to share with them what worked for me. So if you were paying attention, that's the practical application of 1 through 12. Right? Did you hear it? It works, it really does. It has become a working part of my mind in spite of myself, without my permission. My first thought is not always in question anymore. 27 years later, very occasionally, I know exactly how to act like a grown-up. Without any fire or knives or guns. So I'd like to encourage the newcomer. If you are new, if it's your 8th day or your 50th day or your 30th day and you're struggling, welcome to your tribe. We have been exactly where you are. And you never have to have another 50th day or another 8th day of struggling. You never have to feel that way ever again. If you don't have a home group and you're looking, Central is awesome. So is College Park Triangle. Two options. If you don't have a sponsor here at Central, we have a temporary sponsor list. You need a sponsor. If you're an alcoholic, you are an idiot. You need a sponsor. Because it takes one to know one. Right? So get a sponsor to help you. You are cheating yourself if you don't have a guide through this spiritual program. You're cheating yourself. I have found that I hear God in the breath between two alcoholics sharing honestly with one another. If the whole God thing is freaking out, you think we're a cult, you think we want to brainwash you, again, welcome to your tribe. We have felt that way too. And you will find if you come to enough meetings and keep an open mind that there will be someone in a meeting that will share and you will connect with them. And their ideas of what this higher power might be might connect with what you might think it is. So at some point in my sobriety, I really wanted to define that higher power thing, and I went all around the world from Haleakala in Maui to the American Southwest to Singapore to Yokozuna, Japan, searching for God. I think I was on my way back from Okinawa, and I sat down with my sponsor, and she said, did you find God in Asia? And I said, no, I still can't really define this idea of a higher power. And she said, well, if you're really looking for God, all you have to do is turn to page 55 in the big book, and you'll find God. I said, fuck you. I have read that book a million times. God is not in the book. She said, turn to page 55 and read it and call me back. So on page 55 it says, deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the idea of God. I was out here, everywhere out here, looking for something that was right here all along. Something that always fit. I want to encourage you to search within if you're trying to find a higher power of your understanding. I did call her and say, you could have saved me like $120,000 worth of travel. You'd have told me that's like a year. So I'd like to thank you all for your attention. That's my story. I really do want to end by saying, if you're a newcomer, keep coming back. Stay. Get a sponsor, a home group. Ask God for help. We want to help you if you'll reach out to us. If you're not new and you'd like to reach out to someone, I want to encourage you to do that. Again, thank you very much for your attention.